like the rosemary shampoo Cyrielle had brought them. She detected it now as Nero came forward to take her crutches and lean them against the wall so she could sit down. He settled in the chair beside her. Aelia folded her hands on top of her clean white desk, the delicate metal plates of her wrist siphon tinkling as they touched each other. Her fingernails were painted a matte rose and filed into perfect half ovals. Sloane had written her statement the day before and passed it along to Aelia and Nero through Cyrielle, but they had summoned her here this morning anyway, citing the need to ask her a few follow-up questions. She couldn't imagine what more she could say about what had happened. She had already ripped herself apart for them. "So," Sloane said, because no one had spoken for a few seconds, "you had some questions for me?" "How are you feeling, Sloane?" Aelia's smile had to be forced. Sloane wasn't someone people smiled at, and Aelia wasn't someone who smiled. "Peachy," Sloane said. "Your questions?" Aelia glanced at Nero, who cleared his throat. He leaned toward Sloane, his legs crossed at the ankle. His socks had small magic wands on them. Sloane suppressed a smile. "We were concerned for you because we detected a certain sympathy in the tone of your statement," Nero said. "Sympathy for the resurrectionist, that is," Aelia clarified. "What?" Sloane scowled. "He had me kidnapped. Of course I don't have sympathy for him. But in your statement, you said something about him seeming troubled." "He's just different than I expected, that's all." "Different how, exactly?" Nero cocked his head, reminding Sloane of the therapist she had seen after the dive. All furrowed brow and tilted head. "He's not the Dark One," Sloane said. "I thought maybe he was the parallel version of the Dark One from our universe. I see now that's not the case. That's all." "Our concern is not without foundation," Aelia said. "The resurrectionist has swayed people to his cause before. He has a particular charm."
"Charm?"
Sloane raised her eyebrows. "Where in my statement did you see a goddamn thing about him being charming?" "Well, it doesn't begin that way," Nero said. "We suspect he may use some kind of persuasive working." "Who did he do this to before?" Sloane interrupted. Nero and Aelia exchanged a look. "Who she was is of no import," Aelia said.
"She was obviously of import, or you wouldn't be warning me about it," Sloane replied.
Nero glanced at Aelia again. "As I said, we just wanted to check in with you to ensure that..."
"Well, I wanted to talk to you, actually," Sloane said. "Because it sounded like the resurrectionist had dealt with someone in my position before. Another chosen one, I mean. Did Genetrix's chosen one ever meet him? You know, before dying?"
"We did not oversee our chosen one's activities as much as we should have. Perhaps because we believed everything would go according to plan, as the prophecy indicated," Aelia said. "As you can plainly tell, we won't be making that mistake again."
"But I notice you're still not volunteering to fight him yourself," Sloane said.
"It's not wrong to know your own limits," Aelia retorted, her cheeks going pink.
"Isn't it?"
Sloane shrugged. "I've never had the luxury of knowing mine."
"Then you are as unwise as your predecessor," Aelia snapped. "She, too, believed the resurrectionist was merely wounded, that an accord or some kind of reconciliation was possible. She was incorrect, and she paid the ultimate penalty for it. Is that what you wanted to hear?"
The words crashed into Sloane, one at a time. She was incorrect. But when Aelia, standing in the rubble of the old drain site, had told them that Genetrix's chosen one was dead, she had called him he. He
was valiant and a talented worker of magic. He is dead. He was defeated. So the person the resurrectionist manipulated before, it was your chosen one, Sloane said, trying to sound casual. You could have just said, well, I didn't want to alarm you unnecessarily, particularly so soon after a traumatic event. Aelia straightened her crisp shirt. Sloane leaned back in her chair. She had just caught Aelia using two different pronouns for the same person. But she didn't want to call attention to it. Not yet. Do I seem alarmed? Sloane said. Or do I seem pissed that you're trying my patience when all I want to do is kill this asshole and go home? Aelia pursed her lips. Cool, Sloane said. Now, if you'll hand over my crutches, I'll be limping back to my room. That's, Esther furrowed her brow, odd. Sloane sat in the doorway facing the elevator so she would see if anyone was coming toward them. Her right leg was stretched out on the broad boards of the floor of Esther's room. Her crutches leaned against the inexplicable holy water stoop fixed to the wall that Esther was using to hold her jewelry. Odd is not the word I would have chosen, Sloane said. Alarming or suspicious, maybe. I don't think I understand what's so alarming, Matt said. He had unbuttoned his shirt cuffs and was rolling up the sleeves. He wore his siphon all the time now. He and Esther both did. That morning, Sloane had caught them turning their breakfast coffees into ice. People misspeak all the time. It probably doesn't mean anything. Have you ever randomly started referring to me as he? Sloane said. Well, no, Matt said. But maybe they were trans, and Aelia just slipped up with the pronouns. Or maybe she didn't really know them at the time, or... Esther interrupted him. Why didn't you just ask her about it when it happened? I figured if she told one lie, she might tell another, Sloane said. Seemed safer to hold it in for the time being. I still think, Matt began. Esther cut him off again. Don't be dumb, she said. Aelia was obviously talking about two different people. Nero and Aelia have been lying to us, but we don't know why. It's just as likely it's for a good reason as a bad one. I can't believe you guys. Sloane slapped the floor with her palm. These people kidnapped us from another dimension. They're holding us hostage until we fight their bad guy, and you're having trouble believing they would lie to us? Why? Because they said please and thank you? Always with the drama. Esther rolled her eyes. All I'm doing is trying not to freak out. I'm not campaigning for them to get the Nobel Prize. Matt was toying with the string that kept his siphon tight to his hand, turning it around and around his fingertip. Even if Aelia did lie, and it was for some insidious reason, he said, what are we supposed to do about it? Our only path home is still through her. He wasn't wrong, Sloane thought. No matter what Aelia was hiding, no matter what was really going on with Genetrix and Earth, wouldn't they still do whatever they had to get home? The thought of spending the rest of her life here, surrounded by taffeta and the clink of siphon plates, made her feel suffocated. This was not her planet, not her life. Even if she had nothing but heartache waiting for her back on Earth, moving out of the apartment she shared with Matt, grieving over Albie, navigating the scrutiny of the media, at least that life belonged to her. But she couldn't forget the strange relief of hearing Aelia make her misstep, of finally having a name for what she had been feeling since she pulled herself out of the Chicago River. She was being lied to. And Sloane hated lies unless she was the one telling them. I'll get proof, Sloane said, and I'll confront her with it. She won't be able to lie to me then. I can talk to Cyrielle, Matt offered, Just casually, not an interrogation. Sloan recognized that as the peace offering it was, and gave him a small smile. Nothing like a casual conversation about dead chosen ones over dinner, Esther said. Cyrielle, huh? Sloan said. She meant to tease him, but it came out sounding flat, almost accusatory. Something else you'd like to ask? He said quietly. Sloan felt that awful swelling inside her, in her throat, in her chest, in her stomach. That meant she might burst into tears. She put her hands on the doorframe behind her and pushed herself to her feet. No, she said once she was steadier. I'm gonna go. Tired. It was obviously a lie, but Matt, in his infinite courtesy, let her tell it.
Excerpt from The Mammoth Treasury of Unrealist Poetry, Volume 2, Le Quoi, by Artificiel. What is it? Is it? Is it? What?
Chapter 28. The weeks that followed brought Sloan boredom and frustration. The doctor had told her not to train with siphons for 2 weeks at least, so no one bothered her about practicing. She wasn't supposed to walk without crutches, and the crutches hurt her armpits, so she spent most of her time in one place, reading the manifestation of impossible wants. That place was a small bench down the hall from Nero's workshop. Few people approached the doors. Even fewer made it through them. And those who did were always escorted by Nero himself. It was as if the magic keeping the door secure responded only to him. That was why she had chosen his office as her target instead of Aelia's. The Praetor had at least granted Nero and Cyrielle access to her space. Nero had granted access to no one, which meant he was protecting something important. At first, Sloane tried to think of an excuse for Nero to let her in. But Nero himself had become more elusive in the days since their conversation in Aelia's office. He had asked her why she liked to read on that bench the first day he saw her there, and she had gestured to the window across from it, which had a view of the Sears Tower. After that, he took another route to his workshop so he didn't have to walk past her. It took 2 weeks for Sloan to hear it. She had gotten up when she saw Nero approaching the workshop doors and rushed forward, as much as she could, anyway, to engage him in conversation. But he'd pretended not to see her and slipped into the workshop just as she was close enough to speak to him. She watched as the heavy double doors closed and then the shift of a deadbolt. She had been assuming that Nero secured his office through some kind of working on the threshold. But what if his magic was applied only to the lock? After that, Sloane begged some money from Cyrielle and went to a nearby hardware store. Wearing a new brace that she didn't need to use her crutches with, to buy a hammer and a screwdriver. I can't believe I agreed to this, Esther said. Don't act like I dragged you here, Sloane said, pointing at her with the screwdriver. It had a royal blue handle and the brand name, Sifona Technica, stamped in gold along the side. Sloane hooked a finger around Esther's watch band and brought the watch face closer so she could see the time. All right, let's go. But remember our story if Nero's there. Your leg siphon thing is emitting a high-pitched noise, and we need to have him look at it, Esther said. You know he's not going to buy that, though, right? We could have just gone to Cyrielle. He's not going to be there anyway. I've been watching his ins and outs for 2 weeks, and he never stays past 5. You're such a creep, Sloane smiled with all teeth and shoved the stairwell door open with her shoulder. Together, she and Esther walked down the wide, windowed hallway that led to Nero's workshop. They passed the bench where Sloane had spent so much time reading and a monochromatic pink sculpture that reminded her of a kidney. The double doors of Nero's office looked like they belonged in a castle rather than in the Camel, with huge pins in the old rusty hinges. Lucky for her and Esther. "Just tell me if anyone's coming," she said to Esther, crouching awkwardly in front of the lowest of the three hinges. She stuck the end of the screwdriver up against the bottom of the hinge pin and hit it with the hammer, forcing the pin up. Once it stuck out above the hinge, she wiggled it free. One down, two to go. "So the magic on the door doesn't prevent this?" Esther said. "That seems like a major oversight." "You'd think so, wouldn't you?" Sloane moved on to the second hinge. "But all he does with magic is secure the lock. The working slides the deadbolt in place and holds it there. The magic isn't acting on the door itself, because if it were, why would Nero bother with a mechanical lock at all? It would be unnecessary. They rely on magic for everything here."
"And you thought of this how?"
"I read the newspaper. You wouldn't believe how many robberies happen in this city just because people rely on magic security and forget that practical measures sometimes undo it. They've totally lost touch with how simple things work." Sloane finished the third hinge and stuck the flat head of the screwdriver between hinge and wall to wiggle the door out of place. The magical deadbolt held, so the door dangled oddly from that one point like a loose tooth clinging to its last tender ligament. "Success," she said. She turned sideways and slipped into the office.
"If we get stuck on Genetrix for some reason," Esther said, "you should consider a career as a criminal."
"I'll take it under advisement. Hurry. Somebody's going to notice this door pretty quickly." She turned to look at Nero's workshop for the first time. It was a large space with pale, moody light coming in from a ceiling that was structured like a greenhouse. A geometry of translucent white panels letting in daylight. The walls were covered in decorative stone friezes, making the room look like an ancient temple with holy symbols all around it. But the place itself was cluttered with books and equipment. Bits of old siphons and the tools to fix them. Texts in multiple languages lying open or stacked on top of each other. Esther took something out of her pocket. It was a whistle, about the length of one of her fingers. Sloane had seen people on the street and in the lobby of the Camel with them between their teeth, puffing away as they did more complex workings. Esther stuck the whistle between her lips and blew a long, low note. Nothing happened, so she tried again, her eyes closing and her brow furrowing as she focused her intent. Faint light pricked at the corner of Sloane's eyes, and Esther lunged at a nearby stack of books for a slim black journal hidden in the pile. She flipped to the glowing page and read aloud.
"The Chosen One describes his unique perception of magic as fine strings of light, like threads in a loom, connecting people to each other, to objects, and to the ground. It is that last piece that most interests me. The magic that penetrates the earth must delve deeper than dirt. It must be connected to something in the heart of our planet, something we cannot yet comprehend. Perhaps something broken apart by the missile fired into Tenebrous Gorge, which would account for the promulgation of what we call magic throughout Genetrix."
"Nero's journal?" Esther stopped reading and asked. "Looks like he's got a few," Sloane said, gesturing to a thin whisper of light in a stack near Esther. She wandered through the workshop, looking at the books Nero had left open for any other glimmers she could find. Advanced Siphon Repair, Volume 3. Spine, Chest, Gut. A Study of the Lesser Used Siphons.
string theory for the magical mind. She ran her fingers over the pages as she hobbled to the edge of the room. There she found a small alcove, almost like a window seat. But instead of a cushion, as she'd expected, there was a table. Esther started reading again.
Thus far, I have been able to view other universes, but I have not attempted to act upon them. It is more important at this stage to find a viable universe within which to work. There are a few parameters. The presence of at least some magic for one thing, no language barrier for another. A point of departure within the last 50 or so years to improve the subject's ability to adapt to Genetrix, and a champion, or so-called chosen one, that is capable of completing the task at hand. It is incomprehensibly difficult to find a world that will suit.
She trailed off. The table stood before a window with small diamond-shaped panes. Through them, Sloane could see only the blurred shapes of the city turning black and blue as the sun set. There were a few small objects on the windowsill. A pocket watch with a broken chain. A small pair of pink spectacles. A ring with a purple stone. Beneath the spectacles, which were cat-eye shaped, was a paper crane. Sloane pinched the beak between her thumb and forefinger and held it up to the light. It was as precisely folded as one of Albie's. "Wait, I've got something else," Esther said.
"I have spent days sorting through coalescing clouds of matter that have not yet formed Earth. Molten worlds too toxic to sustain life. Gaseous worlds embroiled in constant storms. I have seen Earths riven in two by massive asteroids. Earths overrun with feathered dinosaurs. Earths saturated with oceans. And I have even seen Earths that are barren from onslaughts of atomic bombs. Earths emptied of human life by some sort of plague. The house is still intact. The morning's breakfast rotten on the table."
Esther moved to another journal, this one red, the size of her palm.
"My champion is dead. He was killed by the resurrectionist last night, at 12:15, on the beach along the lakefront path. The victim of the resurrectionist's favorite method of killing, the antithesis of the magical breath, a kind of magical collapsing."
The paper crane Sloane held was made out of notebook paper, wide ruled. In the ridge of the crane's back, she saw a scribble of pink, like someone had tested a pen. After glancing over at Esther, now flipping through the red journal frantically in search of another glowing page, Sloane tugged the ends of the crane to unmake the origami. The paper had been used to test all sorts of pens, she discovered. But they were in bright colors, shimmering, neon, milky. The kind Albie had used, even after the rest of them teased him for it. But Sloane hadn't seen anything like them on Genetrix. People here used elaborate, old-fashioned instruments. Feather quills, fountain pens, metal styluses retrofitted with ballpoints. "Essie," Sloane said. Esther's voice rang out. "The second of my champions is dead. Oh my God, Sloane." Sloane and Esther locked eyes across the room. "The second," Esther said. "Isn't that supposed to be us?" Sloane said, forgetting the notebook paper in her hand for a moment. "Genetrix's chosen one was first, and then they brought us here, right?"
"So the story goes,"
Esther replied, a distant look in her eyes. "Keep going," Sloane said.
"My search will continue, must continue, until a suitable candidate presents itself. I will scour the endless worlds for a lifetime if I need to."
"That lying sack of shit," Sloane said. "How many were there?" Esther stared at Sloane. "Dozens?" Hundreds. If they didn't survive, how the hell are we supposed to? We barely beat our Dark One, and that was on a world that didn't know magic. She choked and fell silent. If he's lying about this, he could be lying about a lot of other things, Sloane said. How hard it is to send us home, for one thing. She crossed the room and put her hands on Esther's shoulders. Don't freak out. Not yet, anyway. What's that? Esther was looking at the paper crumpled between Sloane's hand and her shoulder. It was a paper crane, Sloane said. It reminded me of... Oh. Something like pity softened Esther's eyes, and Sloane pulled away. We got what we came for, Sloane said. Now let's go before Nero. I'm afraid it's a bit too late for that, Nero said. He tapped the lock that held the door in place with a finger, and the door fell to the ground with a loud bang. Sloane, acting on instinct, brandished the sheet of notebook paper in Nero's general direction. All three of them, Nero, Esther, and Sloane, just stared at the page she was holding like a sword until she put it down. For just a moment, as Nero stomped on the fallen door, his teeth gritted, his blonde hair spilling into his eyes, Sloane saw someone to be afraid of. But then, he brushed off his gray sweater with both hands, flicked his hair out of his face, and again became mildness personified. I am not sure what I did to provoke suspicion profound enough for you to break into my workshop, Nero said evenly. Sloane had a sudden, desperate desire to find whatever sensitive place she had just discovered in him and dig in as hard as she could. Well, there was the whole kidnapping three people from a parallel dimension thing, Sloane said. But most recently, it was Aelia referring to the Chosen One as alternately she and he in the span of one conversation. Ah. Nero ran his fingers over the door handle. I told her you noticed that. She didn't listen. We came here for proof, Sloane said. So unless your diaries are your first attempt at novel writing, not great, by the way. How many were there? The question was sudden and shrill. Esther lurched toward him, looking like she might strangle him. How many Chosen Ones did you rip from their dimensions to fight your goddamn Dark One? The only reason you weren't told is I didn't want to alarm you, Nero said. Any of you. Not when you didn't know magic. Not. I take it these are really valuable books, Sloane said, picking up one of the journals and holding it open by the spine as if preparing to rip it in half. In fact, Sloane jerked the two halves of the journal apart, tearing it down the binding. There's no need to be. I don't know, I kind of feel the need, Sloane said. Considering you didn't mention that we're, what, 10th in line to fight your little death match for you? You, Nero said, suddenly quiet, are fifth. Fifth? Esther shrieked. We summoned others because we did not want to summon inexperienced, barely competent magic users to fight the Resurrectionist, Nero said, raising his voice. He clenched his siphon hand into a fist, and sparks danced over the metal plates. We mined universes with successful Chosen Ones who were also capable magic users. All of them fell to the Resurrectionist. All for the sake of Earth and Genetrix. Finally, we couldn't stand the losses anymore. We decided that a personal stake in the fight might compensate for a lack of magic experience. So we took you. Yes. 10 years of battles, and finally we took you. He scowled down at his hand as if it were disobeying him. The sparks faded. Did it seriously never occur to you that you didn't need a chosen one at all? Sloane said. You act like others have not attempted to take him down, Nero said. For every chosen one we have had, at least 10 ordinary men and women have died trying to kill him. And that does not, by the way, include all the thousands of people who have died in the drains. Esther's cheeks shone with tears. I kept it from you because it is alarming and demoralizing, Nero said, quiet again. Because I didn't want any of you to feel defeated before you even made an attempt. I knew that you, Sloane in particular, were still fragile, incapable of accessing your magic reliably, and then you were taken by the Resurrectionist and... I, Sloane said, am not fragile. I don't intend to insult you, Nero said. But you suffered a unique trauma at the hands of your Dark One, and... Shut up! It wasn't Sloane who interrupted him this time, but Esther. She wiped her cheeks dry and tugged at the neck of her stiff blouse to draw attention to her siphon. Or I will set you on fucking fire. Nero showed his palms. Come on, Esther said to Sloane. We have to tell Matt. Unless you have other lies to confess to. Sloane tried her best to look dignified as she hobbled toward the door, following Esther. When she reached the threshold, Nero spoke again. Don't forget, he said, and his voice was cold enough to make the back of her neck prickle. All of you still need me to get home. And you need to kill the Resurrectionist if you want a home to go back to. Sloane didn't turn. She just kept walking, unevenly, toward the elevator. I have returned with a gift, Matt announced from the doorway of Sloane's room. They had started calling it the White Room, for obvious reasons. Matt's was the cabin, and Esther's was the church. Sloane was sitting with her back against the headboard. Esther, wearing sweatpants, was on the floor, two fingers stuck in a jar of peanut butter. They had all taken to eating peanut butter, in sandwiches, on apples, spread over crackers, because the brand, Nutty Buddy, was the same on Earth and Genetrix, and so was the flavor. One of the only perfect matches they had found. Matt held up a bottle of dark liquor. Bourbon, he said. Courtesy of Cyrielle. Esther applauded. Was she apologizing for not telling us we're fucked? Sloane said from the bed. She didn't know, Matt said. She's only been working for Aelia for a year. Sloane snorted. Do not scorn the one who got us bourbon, Matt said. Just because you got affirmed in trusting no one. My worldview is the correct worldview, Sloane said. And you expect me not to gloat? Matt laughed, and for a moment, they were what they had been before. He unscrewed the cap of the bourbon and took a swig. As he swallowed, he passed the bottle to Esther. I don't agree that we're fucked, though, Matt said. We're the fifth in line to fight the Resurrectionist, Esther said. We're the only ones who don't really know how to use magic. One of us has already gotten kidnapped. She sat up and offered the bottle of bourbon to Sloane, who took it and sipped. The bourbon tasted like vanilla and peanuts. Sloane winced and passed it back to Matt. We're fucked, Esther finished. That's the thing, though. Matt sat on the floor next to Esther, took a swig from the bottle, and passed it to Esther. I think there's something to it, the whole history repeating itself thing. Sloane raised an eyebrow. If history wants to repeat, that's fine with me, Matt said. We won last time, remember?
Man's got a point,
Esther said, pointing the bottle at him.
I don't know, Sloane said. I don't think we should fight at all.
And just let the Resurrectionists destroy both of our universes? Matt said.
Nero lying about this means everything could be a lie. The universes might not be connected. The Resurrectionist might not be our enemy.
Not our enemy? Matt was incredulous. He kidnapped you. He's killed God knows how many people. He was controlling the drain.
I know. Sloane leaned her forehead against her hand. I know that, okay? I'm just saying.
We verified the connection between universes, Esther said, giving Sloane the bottle. You found that article.
One article doesn't prove it definitively, Sloane said. And now we know Nero's a liar.
And we know the Resurrectionist is a murderer, Matt said.
I'm not saying we should go grab a beer with him or anything, just that we should be more thorough about confirming what Nero says.
She held the bottle out to him. Yeah. Okay.
Matt grabbed it and drank. A few hours later, the bourbon was almost gone, and Esther was splayed across the foot of the bed, fast asleep. Sloane had the bottle cradled in her lap, and Matt was on the floor, leaning against the wall. They had been quiet for a long time, but neither of them had left. Sloane didn't want to. She wanted to stay inside the quiet company for as long as she could.
This sucks, Matt said out of nowhere.
Sloane nodded.
I don't know how to not be with you, he said. Can't date anyone normal at home. Can't stop seeing you altogether.
I mean, you could, Sloane said. He shook his head.
No. You and me and Esther and Inez, we're bound for life. It's like a marriage. Better or worse, sickness and health.
Sloane gripped the bourbon bottle tightly.
You ever think we should just stay here? Matt said. Nobody knows we're chosen here. Could go on a real date. Nobody staring. Nobody asking for an autograph.
You wouldn't be able to get the best table just by winking, Sloane pointed out.
Yeah, he sighed. And probably they'd racially profile me. Win some, lose some.
Sloane stifled a laugh. It wasn't actually funny. None of this was. But the bourbon had made mirth bubble up inside her like carbonation. And everything seemed soft at the edges. She cleared her throat, trying to bring it all back into focus.
You'll figure out how to do this, she said.
We both will. We'll figure out how to be friends. Matt sniffed. A tear ran down his cheek, and he wiped it away.
I know.
I'm not okay, she said. I know I seem like I am. I'm good as long as I keep moving. But when we're home, when I stop, she made an explosion sound. Pop goes the Sloaney.
I guess that shouldn't be reassuring, he said. But it is.
Sloane put the bottle on the nightstand and closed her eyes. Chapter 29. It didn't take long for Matt to demand further proof of the connection between universes, or for Aelia to agree to give it to him. She had to have heard about Sloane and Esther breaking into Nero's office, and she likely wanted to appease them. At least, that was Sloane's theory. So it was only 2 days later that Aelia, Cyrielle, Sloane, Matt, and Esther stood on the edge of the river, looking out over the water. 2 years after the fall of the Dark One, the five Chosen Ones had presided over the dying of the Chicago River on St. Patrick's Day. Esther had put on a green dress covered in sequins and a green wig to match it. She had looked like the queen of a parade. They had stood on the deck of a boat, the orange powder dye spraying behind them, turning the murky water electric, while a massive crowd cheered. "There are places where the boundaries of our universes appear to be more permeable," Aelia said now. "We have been able to detect where a few of those places are. Water appears to be a commonality among them. This is one of them." Sloane thought of the ballistic missile loosed from the USS Tenebris rocketing toward the deepest part of the ocean. And of diving for the needle, the flippers on her feet propelling her deeper than she ought to have gone. And of the blast that had thrown her into the water when the Dark One died. And the eerie glow of his cheek as he turned away from her. Water, she thought. Sure. "We do not have the power necessary to break through the barrier between our universes now," Aelia said. "Nothing will be able to pass through it. But our former Chosen One taught us that magic can be observed. We can do a working to help one of you perceive the magical connections that exist. However, one of you must swim down to where the barrier is thinnest to witness what we have seen of the connections between universes. Which one of you is the strongest swimmer?" Sloane felt everyone's eyes on her. She was, after all, the first one to have emerged from the same river, and the one who had gotten her scuba diving certification when training to retrieve the needle. And the one who had spent summers at the community pool with Cameron, the two of them challenging each other to hold their breath longer and longer and longer. "Me," Sloane said. Aelia's mouth pinched like she was sucking on hard candy, but she nodded. Today she wore three clashing black and white patterns: striped billowing slacks, a houndstooth jacket with a long line of tiny buttons, a checkerboard cape with a high collar. She reminded Sloane of a circus performer. "We can do a working on you so that you can breathe underwater for a short time," Aelia said, "if that's all right with you." "Yeah," Sloane said. She bent over to untie her shoe. Her other leg was still wrapped in a siphon. "Sure." As Aelia cast a working to keep Sloane warm in the cold water, Cyrielle produced a large handkerchief from one of her sleeves, shaking it out like a magician performing a trick. She placed it over Sloane's nose and mouth and tied it at the back of her head. Then Aelia brought all her fingertips together and let out a trill from her tooth implant, a note higher than she could have sung on her own. Sloane winced at the sound, but the kerchief inflated around her face like a balloon, her air supply. Sloane shed her outer layer. Wearing just a shirt and her underwear, she walked to the edge of the river. There were goosebumps all over her legs. She stared into the dim water and saw no reflection. "And now the working that will help you see the connections," Aelia said, her hand clasping Sloane's shoulder. Sloane felt the cold of the siphon's plates through the fabric of her shirt. Cyrielle clasped her other shoulder. The note from Aelia's implant was so low, Sloane could hardly hear sound in it, only felt its vibration against the back of her neck. Cyrielle's joined in at a higher, dissonant pitch. Then both women's hands fell away. Sloane turned around and saw light. Strings of light enfolding Cyrielle, Matt, Esther, Aelia, extending from their feet and into the ground, penetrating the cracks in the concrete sidewalk. Slants of light like the sun's rays passed over the buildings behind them. Light shone through the windows of the high-rises
and wrapped around them like string around a yo-yo. The city was bright with magic, swollen with it.
"Go,"
Aelia said, and the light came out of her mouth like a waterfall. "Or you'll run out of air." Sloane bent her knees and dove. From beneath, the water was murky as a lake, but light from the world above followed her down. She kicked like a bullfrog, wishing she had her flippers. She could breathe, but the pressure against her ears and sinuses was oppressive. A rope of magic stretched down from the surface of the water. She hadn't seen it above the river, but here it was, as thick as her arm. Sloane swam alongside it, each kick forcing her farther and farther down. She had never felt so profoundly alone in her life. Not just isolated or by herself, but truly alone. The only person in darkness that went on forever, with only the rope as company. Even if she had not been able to see the rope, though, she would have known that something was wrong about this place. She felt the prickle of it in her fingers. The Chicago River was only 20 or so feet deep at its deepest, and she had already swum farther than that. Wherever she was now was not the bottom of the river in Genetrix. And then she saw it. A flicker of light up ahead, at the end of the rope. A glint of gold. She kicked harder, swimming toward it, following the rope like a child chasing the end of a rainbow. Her head was in a vice of magic. Tingles raced up her arms and down her legs. She felt like the river water was closing in on her, forming a black tunnel. The plants growing on the floor of the river brushed her bare knees. The glint was a thread of silver. No, just something that looked like silver. The needle. Startled by the sight of it, she stopped swimming and drew herself upright. Her head hit something hard and grainy, a chunk of concrete. She put her palm against it and turned so it was beneath her. Just beyond the concrete was a twisted piece of metal. It took shape when she came closer. It was huge, broader across than her wingspan, and disappearing into the metal that surrounded it. It was the top of a P. It was one of the overlarge letters that had been on Trump Tower before the destructive magic that ended the Dark One's life had leveled the building. She had dived among this rubble that had sunk to the bottom of the river, searching for any sign of the Dark One's body. And now it was above her, below her. Sloane looked down, up, at the plants that were impossibly growing toward the rubble. There was debris hidden among the stems, soda cans, glass bottles, a warped hubcap. A fragment of metal with the Abraxas logo on it. That was Genetrix. And below, above her, the remnants of the tower they had destroyed while killing the Dark One. Between them, afloat but somehow immovable, was the needle. As ever, Sloane was drawn by its magnetism, the tingling cold that washed over her body at the thought of it. She felt like she could have just swum over and pinched it between her fingers. It wanted her. She knew it. And she wanted it too. But when she reached for it, her hand missed it, like she had misjudged the distance. When she tried again, the same thing happened, her fingers glancing off to the right. Odd. She was about to try a third time when she saw something else. It was a pale, quick thing, like a fish without the glimmer of scales. As it turned, it took the shape of a man, hair floating away from his head, softened by the water, clothes dark, shoes with hard leather soles. Terror clutched at her chest. The Dark One.
It was a memory. A hallucination. It had to be. She was just running out of air and it was messing with her mind. She needed to go back. Instead, she swam forward, thrashing through the water with as much energy as she could muster. Frog-like, hands outstretched. She saw the gnarl of scars on the back of her right hand, where the needle had been, and kicked harder, trying to catch the shoe. She saw the shadow ahead of her, and the glow of magic that surrounded it. Sloane screamed into the water, which tasted like weeds and mildew. The shadow was shrinking, and the rubble had gone away, as had the needle and the river plants. She swam harder, legs and arms burning, and broke through the surface of the river. Esther's and Matt's faces right above her. "I think," she coughed, reaching for the hands they extended to her. She yanked the cloth down from her face, spat up some water, and began again. "I think the Dark One, our Dark One, is still alive." "He can't be," Esther shook her head. They were still on the riverbank. Aelia had dried Sloane off with a working, and she was now pulling her pants back on, her arms and legs trembling from exertion. "We never found a body," Sloane said.
"You dove in the river," Esther said. "You found his button, part of his jacket. There was so much rubble."
"We wanted him to be dead, so we convinced ourselves he was," Sloane said.
"Then why didn't he come back to finish us off? It's not like we were so scary he had to run to another dimension to get away from us."
Esther's gestures were wide and frantic. She almost struck Matt in the face before he stepped away from her. Neither he nor Aelia had spoken yet. They seemed content to watch as Sloane and Esther argued.
"I don't know," Sloane said. "Maybe whatever he was doing on Earth, he'd finished. Maybe he got tired of playing with us and wanted to find some new toys. I'm not a fucked up supervillain. I don't know the logic."
"But you know the logic of trippy underwater hallucinations," Esther said. "You see him swimming away and suddenly you're convinced he's alive and we should just trust you on that?"
"When has my gut ever failed us when it comes to the Dark One?" Sloane demanded.
"I said he would fall for our trap, and he did. I said I would be good bait, and I was. I said to let Albie come and fight with us, and he turned out to be the reason we won. And I was the only one who was so convinced the Dark One might not be dead that I fucking scuba dived in the Chicago River. A deeply unpleasant experience, might I add. And now, yeah, I expect you to believe that my gut isn't wrong on this one. Is that really so insane?"
Esther stared at Sloane, her eyes full of tears. Sloane thought she might always remember Esther this way. Her arms slack at her sides, her eyes shining, the moon glowing behind her. No matter what happened to them after this.
"Sloane," Matt said, and Sloane tensed in anticipation, though she wasn't sure why. "Your gut never led us astray before," Matt said. "But now, it tells you all kinds of things. That you're still a captive of the Dark One in the middle of the night when you're at home in our bed. That you could trust that Mox guy, who probably sold you out to the Resurrectionist. That you needed to go visit Genetrix's Bert."
"Fuck you," Sloane said in a low voice.
"Don't you dare use a fucking night terror against me like that. You're just pissed because my gut told me to dump you. Because of course there must be something wrong with my head if I don't want to marry the goddamn saintly chosen."
"God, Sloane, this is the fucking problem with you. You don't know how to fight without drawing blood, and you never have."
"Both of you, stop," Esther said, and she choked back a sob.
"I can't take it. I need to get home, okay? I need to."
My mom is dying. So why don't you stop bickering like a bunch of children and tell me the fastest way to do that?
Matt and Sloane stared at each other. His jaw shifted, like he was working on a particularly tough bite of meat.
Sloane just felt tired. She looked out over the river. She no longer remembered why she was so convinced that the Dark One was still alive. That he had swum through the barrier between universes instead of dying. Only that she was. And no one, not even Esther, believed her.
"Fight the Resurrectionist," Matt said. "We kill him, they send us home. That's our best bet."
"Sloane?" Esther said. Sloane felt the same wrongness she felt around the needle. Like all her innards were in the wrong places. Like the world had turned into a nightmare, and she didn't remember falling asleep.
"Fine," she said. "Sure. Let's do it."
But she wasn't sure if she'd said it because she meant it, or if she just wanted Esther to stop crying. Part 3.
Excerpt from The Manifestation of Impossible Wants, A New Theory of Magic, by Arthur Solowell. What, then, is a desire? We may begin by stating what it is not. A desire is not a whim. It is not an idle wish concocted on a sunny afternoon. A desire is a profundity of want, a deep and abiding craving that cannot be denied. It is for this reason that it is impossible to force someone to perform an act of magic one does not truly wish to do. The magic requires desire, and a desire cannot be threatened or manipulated into being. It may become clear to us as we watch magic develop and change in our world that certain people are not to be trusted with the wealth of power that magic offers. This is not because they are wicked, but because they are damaged beyond repair. They may proceed through the world as if their desires conform to those of the healthy and functional among us, but that may not be the case. When they do magic, their true selves will be laid bare before them and before us all. In other words, magic is a mirror. It reflects us back to ourselves, and we may not always like what we see.
Top Secret. Cordis Memorandum for the Record. To Director, Central Intelligence Agency. From Thomas Wong, Praetor of the Council of Cordis. Subject: Project Delphi Prophecy.
As requested, I have included the exact wording of the prophecy of Codename Sybil, made on 16 February 1999, verified by the Council of Cordis. It will be the end of Genetrix, the unmaking of worlds. Something stands between Genetrix and its twin. The Dark One will excise it, and the worlds will be crushed together. And that will be the end of all. The Dark One of Genetrix will be hidden, but not secret, with a thirst that will never be slaked. Their equal is the hope of Genetrix, born marred by magic and mastered by a power previously unknown to us. Twice will equals greet each other anew, and the fate of the worlds is in their hands.
From the Journal of Nero Dulce, Counselor of Cordis. Essentially, in order to cross into another universe, one must simplify one's understanding of what such an act entails. The magnitude of moving from one world to another is too much for the human brain, no matter how advanced, to handle. They will therefore not be able to summon the appropriate level of desire. As defined by Solowell in The Manifestation of Impossible Wants. However, if we simplify it so that anyone may understand it, we may be able to shuttle people of any intellectual capacity across universes. The comparison that I have chosen is one of basic hospitality. A person's universe is her home. The permeable barrier between the universes is her front door. If a polite guest wishes to enter a house, he knocks on the front door, and the person within the house opens it to let him in. It is the same with universes. You must reach out with your magic to knock, and someone dwelling in that universe must open the door. What makes this more complicated, of course, is that time behaves differently across universes. You may think you are knocking on a Wednesday at a reasonable hour of 10 o'clock in the morning. However, in that universe, you may actually be knocking at the stroke of midnight, or 20 years later, when the owner of the house is long dead.
Chapter 30. A cold wind found its way under the hood of Sloane's cloak, making her shiver. It was hours past sunset, and she stood at the border of Wacker Drive and the most recent drain site, her last checkpoint before she got in position. Even Esther had eventually come around to Matt's way of thinking. "You've been acting so strong since we got here," Esther had said to her, quietly, the night of the incident.